was always a bit of a propeller head. I was always fascinated by aviation and all, you know, thought about joining the Air Force rather than studying medicine.
That, folks, is the voice of David Borshoff, my friend, anesthesiologist. And while he never joined the Air Force, he did indeed train for and eventually get a pilot's license.
You know, I become quite an experienced consultant, and I felt that there was not much that I couldn't handle after the sort of training that I had.
And the kind of training we're talking about, in addition to an anesthesia residency, was postgraduate training in transplant anesthesia, cardiac anesthesia. And then he started his career doing open bariatric cases. I don't know if anyone is around during that generation, but those were not easy operations. So this is an experienced clinician we're talking about here.
And then in about 2004, 2005, I met this lovely lady from California who was up, who had been visiting Perth in Western Australia, and her name was Irma Braley. And she tripped, broke a hip, and she had some surgery. And I happened to be the anesthesiologist on call that day. And I don't know why, we established a great rapport. It was late in the evening. I don't normally see my patients for 40 minutes after I've done a long list during the day, but that she was very engaging. She was in her 60s, very sensible, great common sense. We had similar sort of values. She was a school teacher, like my mother was a school teacher. So there was probably a bit of transference going on. But it was just a really lovely encounter, and I anesthetized her the next day, and everything went well. And then, given the nature of the private system in our country, about a week later, she had to come back to the operating theater because she was dislocating her hip. So the joint wasn't functioning the way it should, and the surgeon took her back. I knew nothing about this. And I was actually in the theater next door with another surgeon that I regularly work with. And of course, if I'm not available to do the case, they'll find another anesthetist. And that's essentially what happened. And he used an epidural technique. And one of the nurses came in to me and gave me a tap on the shoulder and said that it looked like things weren't going the way they would like them to go in the theater next door. To cut a long story short, it seemed that she had a complication from the epidural that was unrecognized. I think it might have ended up being a total spinal, an undiagnosed total spinal.
Just for you folks not familiar with the term, the total spinal or high spinal is a spread of the neuraxial anesthesia that you want to stay in the lower spinal levels to get, for instance, a lower body operation done. It spreads up higher. It actually knocks out the sympathetic chain and eventually knocks out the patient's respirations in its severe form. So you have a apneic hypotensive bradycardic patient. This is not fun. And if you do not recognize it quickly, it can be life-ending.
And the next thing I knew, there was a cardiac arrest spell, and I was involved in her resuscitation. And I learned a lot of, at that stage in my career, I actually learned a lot from that one resuscitation that we did. And what I learned was that despite all my training, the fact that I was 6 or 7 years into my consultancy, and that I was a cardiac anesthetist didn't necessarily mean I was great at managing a resuscitation, because all the high-powered stuff that I did was all planned for in cardiac. You know, you have all your lines in, you sort of expect certain things to happen. You're always hyper-vigilant because things can go wrong. But when you're doing routine cases, it often catches you off guard. And anyway, we resuscitated this lady for, you know, we did CPR on her. I remember desperately feeling the anxiety of not knowing why she had arrested, you know, trying to find a solution. And we were doing CPR, and I was actually doing CPR at one stage, and the time was going on. And I actually personally found it very distressing. It was a life-changing moment, because here was this woman that I had anesthetized and chatted to and learned all about their life in California a week before. And now she was essentially moribund. She was purple and blotchy in the fingertips. Her pupils were dilated. She looked awful. And I actually thought we had lost her. I called for one of the ICU consultants to come in because I was going to call the end of the, I remember distinctly thinking, there's no point in continuing. At the 30-minute mark, I always thought, you know, there's no point in continuing. If I'm going to call the end of the resuscitation, I'm going to do it with another senior consultant to make sure that I wasn't missing anything. So I called for an ICU consultant to come over and essentially just hold my hand, basically, as I called the end of the resuscitation. But in fact, he was caught up in an ICU and couldn't get over straight away. And then another colleague walked in while, you know, and trust me, the systematic approach to sort of cardiac arrest of giving a, you know, epinephrine every second cycle, that was out the window. I was just emptying the kitchen drawer, basically, into this at this stage. And surprisingly, there was a turnaround, and then someone said they could feel an output. And, you know, one thing led to another. She got an output back. I set up some noradrenaline, adrenaline infusions, and we transferred to the ICU. And I actually felt gutted. I honestly thought that if she survived this, that it was almost going to be worse than if that we hadn't got it back, because she would be in a vegetative state. And having known her history as well as I did, I just felt gutted. And then the next morning when I came in to start my list, I went into ICU to see how she was, and she was extubated, sitting in a chair and complaining of sore ribs.
That experience was a spark, and that spark eventually became a fire.
So, you know, I did a lot of reflection after that resuscitation, and I thought I wasn't happy with the way it had gone. I was obviously delighted that we had saved her, and that the family had her for another 10 years or so, and the grandkids had her for another 10 years or so. But my own personal performance and approach to that resuscitation suggested to me that I needed to stay sharp, and I needed to be rehearsing this sort of stuff, and I wanted to get involved in getting to that point.
So what David did is he started doing simulations. He started simulating crisis with many anesthesia providers. What he discovered was a need for something similar to what he had in the cockpit when he was flying. In the cockpit of every aircraft is what's known as a QRH, a quick reference handbook, a guide to any emergency or procedure you'd need to know in that plane. And he asked himself, why is there not something similar for anesthesia? His first attempt to fill this void was called Cards for Crisis Control, and it was a keychain with 8 laminated cards on it that covered key emergencies. This did not take off. And so he kept working, he kept coming up with new ideas, and eventually the idea came for what was to become the Anesthesia Crisis Manual. This book was a beautifully designed, water-resistant tome of all the emergencies you may find in the operating room that you might see once in your career, and also the emergencies that you might see more often and yet forget key factors. While you might want a copy of this in your home library or taking it around to refresh your memory, I think it truly came into its own when it was hanging on the anesthesia machine of every operating room in a hospital. In fact, he had a plastic place you could actually chain this book up to the anesthesia machine. And then it's there. You look down and you know if something happens, the book is here. On the left side of every topic was the immediate actions that needed to be taken for stabilization. And then on the right, additional information and things that were less critical. I got my hands on one of these anesthesia crisis manuals, and I was blown away. It had little to do with my day-to-day clinical management. The things in the book are primarily suited to anesthesiologists, but the concept resonated with me, and it brought to mind a recording I had done on the MCRIT podcast.
An aviation concept introduced on day one of pilot training is that of the boldface. The boldface are corrective procedures that address those emergencies or tactical situations that you absolutely have to do something about right now, or people will die. There's only a few of these for each jet, In the F-15, there was maybe six or so. Things like engine fire, spin recovery, the no-shitters, as we called them. After you accomplish the boldface for that serious emergency, you smoke a lucky, use your resources and other checklists, and solve the problem.
That was Joe Novak, former combat aviator and emergency physician, way back on MCRIT 99. And those words stuck with me, because we need a bold face. We need the no-shitters for resuscitation. And yet, unless there was a tacit transmission of those from a trusted attending down to you as a learner, you might have to discover those no-shitters in blood for a lot of the conditions we have to deal with. And that's not right. There should be a list. And yes, you'd want to commit them to memory, ideally, but you'd need something to memorize. Otherwise, you have to figure these things out yourself. And it's not realistic to memorize all of them, because a lot of conditions are very infrequently seen, once in a career. And yet, when you actually see that patient, you need to know right away how to deal with it. You don't have time to try to figure out which up-to-date article best describes the patient dying in front of you. There should be a list of these no-shitters. And once I saw the anesthesia crisis manual, I realized, this is it. This is the format that emergency medicine and critical care should have to codify the boldface for our specialty.
I was sick of seeing malignant hypothermia cards stuck up on the wall, anaphylaxis things hanging off the side of the machine, telephone numbers scribbled up somewhere. And I just thought there needs to be, and that's when I thought there needs to be a one-stop shop on every anesthetic cart or anesthetic machine. And it needs to have all of this stuff in so that people don't have to look elsewhere.
And that's it right there. So I got in touch with David and said, hey, what do you think about a resus crisis manual? And thus was born a project that took up 4 years of my life. We did things a little differently for the resus crisis manual. David had written the entire ACM himself. We didn't want to go to that direction. We wanted experts in every emergency condition that we were going to put in the book. So we got some of the best authors you can imagine. These folks were incredible. The names read like a who's who of up and coming or already established fomites and medical educators. The work that was submitted was amazing, and spent a couple years editing all of those chapters. And what I think we had at that point was very, very good. I mean, easily the level of any medical textbook out there, easily publishable. And so we sent it on to David. I didn't know David was going to have any involvement in the actual clinical editing, but David ripped everything apart. He asked, can we make this simpler? Can we word this more clearly? Can we figure out a way to reduce the number of steps to really narrow it down to the boldface? And he took every chapter and we went back and forth over an additional 2 years. I know I've gotten plenty of questions. Where's the RCM? Where's the RCM? Well, that's where the RCM was. Every word, every bit of design, how those words sat on the page was agonized over. But it was all worth it. What David forced us to do was create something that I think is as good as we are capable. It doesn't mean it's as good as it could be, but it's as good as we are humanly capable of providing. He took the amazing work of the authors and honed it down to what I think is pretty incredible. I'm sorry if this is sounding like an infomercial. I guess it is kind of like an infomercial. If you buy the book, we'll get a set of Ginsu knives to you right away. But I am just so proud of what the authors have created and what we have been able to edit, and we're finally there. So I hope you don't mind that I'm going to talk about it a little bit more. The resus crisis manual takes the key emergencies, not the stuff you deal with every day. You're not going to have a cardiac arrest algorithm. That's our bread and butter. We do that every day. We don't need that. You know, you might see that very infrequently in the operating room. But for us, postpartum hemorrhage. Do you remember the doses of all those medications? precipitous delivery, local anesthetic toxicity, all the things that will cause a patient to die within minutes, and yet you might not have seen one ever. That's what's in this book, and you should check out the table of contents to see. It is just like the ACM, made out of a synthetic plastic material. That means it is waterproof. That means it will survive the rigorous environment of an emergency department or critical care unit. It is beautifully designed. That's something David brings to the table, is a unique design perspective. And just like the ACM, each topic is two pages. On the left side, the boldface, the no shitters, the 8 to 10 actions that must be accomplished immediately to stabilize the patient. On the right side is additional information, dosages, etc. We've added web pages, or we will soon be adding web pages for each and every topic to add additional information beyond that. The book is available in printed form or in electronic. The electronic form is an enhanced PDF that'll work on any device, so you could always have it with you. If you buy the print version, you get the electronic version. And you don't get just that one single iteration. The nice thing about the way we're publishing is any changes, any errors that are found, we will email you and you can just get an updated electronic version and always have the most current information. Okay. If you want to look at the book, if you want to see the chapters, if you want to see samples, if you want to see table of contents, if you want to see our author list, then just go to resuscrisismanual.com or mcrit.org/RCM. You might be saying, well, come on, I'm an MCRIT listener. I want a discount. And I would love to offer you one. The thing is, there is zero room. There is zero profit on these books for quite a number of sales. Until there is a critical mass of these books being sold, this is pretty much at cost. So there is no room for a discount. I'd love to offer you one. But I think it is definitely worth the money if you're in any resuscitative specialty. I think this will help you. It is both a learning tool. There's no reason not to read this book cover to cover. But then as a reference, as a quick reference handbook, just like pilots, just like combat aviators have sitting there. These people train so far in excess of their actual performance, and yet they feel the need to always have a book they can immediately go to for any emergency to list the critical steps that might be missed. We in emergency medicine and critical care and pre-hospital medicine who perform without very much training relatively desperately need something like this, I feel. I mean, obviously it's self-serving for me to say that, but I really truly believe that. So if this sounds interesting to you, if this sounds like the kind of thing you want to take a look at, just go to mcrit.org/RCM or recesscrisismanual.com. and check it out. Thank you to the authors. Thank you to Mike Stone for all his support and work on this book. And thanks to Dave Borshoff, without who this never would have taken place. Resus Crisis Manual, I think it's good stuff. Scott Weingart for the MCRIT podcast saying bye-bye.